Welcome to Threshold Stories, crossing thresholds one story at a time. I'm your host, Jeff Gora. Thank you for your interest in Threshold Academy's upcoming trip to the Annapurna Sanctuary in the Himalayan region of Nepal, as well as a subsequent side trip into the Dong Valley as soon as we're done. I hope to use these minutes with you to help set some expectations about the trip, as well as answer some questions that I hear a lot. My name is Jeff Gora. I'm going to be your trek leader for both in-country sections of our trip. To start, I decided with a shareable video instead of a link to a web page or a typed out FAQ section, as I decided that some of you are going to need to share this with others before you can commit. For many of you, this is a once and forever sort of experience, and you need as much information as you can before you say yes or no in a meaningful way. Let me start by saying what this is not. This is not a packing list or a two-way back and forth with exchanges on how we're going to handle events if this occurs or if that occurs. It's not a what-if session. But I do want to take the time to create something that you can share that's going to include expectations for what you mentally need to do to be successful, physically need to be to be successful, and what some spiritual components of the trip you might encounter are going to be like, because you'll need that to process some decisions. At the end, I'm going to give you some FAQs that I've heard over the years. And if you see a question that pops up that I don't seem to answer, you can email me at the address at the end of the video or the bottom of the screen or whatever the producers select that works for you. So that's it. Let's jump right into it. So I envision a Himalayan expedition with really five stages to it. The longest stage for sure is stage one. It's the one where that's probably the only time where you can really control the outcome. And that's the pre-trip physical expectation stage. To help you guys set your expectations as best as I can, we're probably never going to go, well, not probably, we won't go more than 7 miles in any single day, and you're never going to carry a backpack. So all the physical fitness you need as far as cardiovascular and leg strength and conditioning, you can get no matter what state in the United States you live in. This isn't restricted to people who can run marathons or half marathons or have previous Himalayan experience. This is an entry-level Himalayan experience that anybody can get ready for. The temperatures you're going to be experiencing there are going to be conducive to ideal hiking. It'll never be hot enough that you're going to overheat and struggle with heat exhaustion. And it's never going to be cold enough so that you're going to be struggling with issues like frostbite. We're neither going to those regions where that's an issue, nor are we going during times of the year where that's a concern. I often find that the people who really are successful on these trips justify the value of the whole trip by the lead up, because it's those 6 months that go into the trip where you actually have a story to tell. You get to tell everybody you're going to the Himalaya, and that's cool. There's no ambiguity to that. You have a reason to exercise and get in shape other than just to get in shape. I can't count the number of people who work out because they like to work out, and that's the end of their sentence. There's no why they're working out. There's no what are you getting ready for? What are you going to do with this tool? It's like you're continually carving on a block of wood with no art museum to ever put it in. This is different than that because you have a reason to do what you're going to do. You're going to be hiking while we're in the Himalaya literally every day for a week. And you have perhaps, some of you, the first time in your life, a reason to be very, very consistent in your fitness, because if you're not consistent in your fitness, no matter what level it is, this will not be as enjoyable for you as somebody who is consistent. We all know hiking and have value in life, not hiking in life. Value in life comes from being responsible and taking up that flag of consistency day in and day out. That's what our heroes do. That's what the successful people of the world who many of us idolize and use as role models do. And too often we've wrecked our diets and our workout regimens because we become inconsistent in our approach to handling them. Hopefully this trip will help you address that character defect if you have it, unlike any other sort of vacation or trip perhaps you've ever planned for. Next thing I'd say that's part of the pre-trip preparation that's real important is you should do as much homework as you feel comfortable doing to try to alleviate any fear. I was afraid the first time I hiked in the Himalaya. And I used to be a ranger in New Mexico. I've done a lot of treks, and it's very normal and natural for people to get scared going to a place you've never been before, especially when there's stories about it and low quality Hollywood videos about people who've gone there and died and things like that. This should be an epic event for you. And the more you learn, the more you address the uncertainties and the fear in your life, the less that fear is going to have control over you. So I can't encourage you enough to do as much homework, talk to others who've gone before, read books, see videos, rewatch this video to recognize that this is not an overwhelming thing. People for thousands of years have been born, raised, and died right there and have nothing but good commentary for it. In fact, that's what partly makes this place so darn famous. Last kind of thing on the pre-prep stuff is sometimes people just don't know what to do to get ready. My recommendation is just go exercise. This is probably this phase one is probably the only phase where there's no such thing as overdoing it. You know, if you find yourself comfortable and competent wanting to run a marathon every month or ride your bicycle 50 miles every single day or swim an hour every single day or walk for 2 hours every single day, you're not overdoing it. The more fit you are, the more you're going to be able to enjoy those scenic vistas as we climb up and down ridgelines throughout the Himalaya. All right, second phase of the trip is the travel phase. Getting to Nepal is a 12 time zone shift from the eastern portion of the United States. You can pick whichever route you want to take. You can fly over the Pacific. You can fly over the Atlantic. Your travel time is not going to be that much different. And because that travel segment for some of you guys is perhaps one of the most nerve-wracking segments, I suggest you accommodate jet lag the way that best works for you. I'm going to be arriving 2 days before the trip starts because I know for my body, I need two days to make a 12 time zone shift. So 6 p.m. and 6 a.m. are inverted and it's not complicated for me. Some of you due to days off, you're going to try to arrive the day the trip starts or whatever, and you're just going to be forced to snap to it. You're going to have to invert everything and walk through the middle of the night and try to sleep through the middle of the day. At least that's what your body's going to tell you. If you have the time off to accommodate jet lag, I strongly encourage you do so in your planning. I believe our trip is starting on October 25th. I'm going to leave the United States on the 21st, which means I'll arrive on the 23rd early in the morning. That'll give me all day the 23rd and all day the 24th to get ready. So when I start greeting you at the airport on the 25th, as you start coming in, I'll have already adjusted quite well to Nepal time or Kathmandu time. On the travel segment, I'm recommending that you shop for airline tickets on Cyber Monday. It's been my experience that the best deals of the year on air travel are on that day. For example, in 2018, we were able to get round trip tickets to Spain for $300 and change out of Charlotte if we booked them on that day, because the carrier we selected had a 50% off as long as you cross an ocean special that day. You can't predict what carrier is going to have what deals, but typically that's the best day to buy tickets. And Cyber Monday should be close enough to the trip that you'll be able to buy the whole round trip ticket. So that's another recommendation. And the other section on the travel segment is the travel readiness. Oftentimes when you're crossing oceans, the airline carriers, whoever you pick, are going to offer you all the alcohol you can drink. I'm going to discourage you from doing that because that causes a dehydration effect. And going into the Himalaya also causes a dehydration effect. Unless you're super awesome at staying hydrated and know how to tweak your system, I would wait to take advantage of the all-you-can-drink alcohol until when you get on the flight to go home. Getting drunk on the way over there may be a lot of fun. You might look forward to it, but there could be a consequence to it. So on the readiness side, I would say that. The other readiness one is kind of a real life story, but as we get closer, we have to look to the healthcare providers to see what the story of the day with health concerns are. Some of you might be flying through airports where there's a specific virus or disease of concern. I know COVID has everybody's attention. I got dengue hemorrhagic fever when I was in Nepal, and it came from not wearing any bug spray when I was in Kathmandu. I knew to do it. I just assumed I wasn't going to have an issue with mosquitoes because it was so cold there, and shame on me. I remember getting stung, and you know, 6 days later, I had a problem associated with getting dengue. So preparing yourself for travel for circumstances, you know, having a, a change of underwear, toothbrush, toothpaste in case you get delayed at an airport somewhere, carrying some mosquito spray, some antibiotic cream in case you get cut somewhere in an airport. All that is smart. I just call that travel readiness, just having things ready for you when you travel. Third segment of the trip is probably the one that people research the most and probably don't need to as much as they do, because the third segment is the hiking segment, and that's the part that's been beat to a pulp. Packing for this trip is going to be a separate video and a separate concern, but for now, just suffice it to say that if something happened to all your luggage and it was only you that survived in Kathmandu, that's not really that problematic. Everything you need for this trip, and I literally mean everything, from every medication you could possibly want, custom shoe, clothing need, packs, water bottles, anything you need is available for purchase in Kathmandu and Pokhara, the two main towns we'll be traversing through. So if you lose everything, it's not that problematic. Again, we're going to have a separate video just on packing, so don't get concerned about that. Our daily routine I'm going to make as matter-of-factual for all of you guys as I can. I'm going to get you up as early as I can, preferably right at sunrise, which should be something like 6 a.m. I'm going to try to make sure we eat quickly and are hiking early. I like to be some of the first people on the trail. That'll allow us to arrive at our destination first, which will give us top pick of the tea houses that we're going to be staying at. And I want you guys to be able to change out of your clothes and get into some really comfortable cotton clothes to hang out with, so you can have as much time as possible to acclimate to the new elevation. Because most every day while we're hiking, you're going to be going to a new elevation, and I want to make sure you guys acclimate as best as you can. The third portion of the hiking segment recommendation that I want you to get in your mind now is some of you walk and you walk alone. You walk alone in your own thoughts. Maybe you're with somebody, maybe you're not. I'm going to encourage you to hang out with a lot of the Nepali nationals who are going to be with us. We're going to have some porters that are Nepali nationals that I'll be working with hiring. I have a couple of Nepali nationals who will be walking with us, and there's going to be some young students hiking with us as well. Kids who are 14 to 19, 20 years old who would not otherwise get to go to the Himalaya. I bring them with us on our trip. Part of the fees that you pay to do this trip covers the cost of bringing four Nepali national youth on the trip with us. I'm going to encourage you also to write. Temptation is to just take your phone out and take a lot of pictures and go nuts with all things associated with that, because you're not going to get to do that in the States. And there's nothing wrong with that, but taking a few moments to record thoughts or create some selfie videos or videos describing what your experience is the stuff of lifetime memory. You want to do that. And another thing I'm going to encourage you to do is if you do find yourself staying up late, getting up early, can't go to sleep in the middle of the night, just step outside and stare at creation. We're going to be at a pretty high elevation. We're not going to have any washout effect from any nearby cities. You're going to see the galaxy like you've perhaps never seen it unless you've been to Alaska or Canada or something, because you generally don't have views in our country that are like that. Just go out there and take a stare at it, because it is truly wow. The temperatures might deter you. Fear of the unknown might deter you. But I assure you, if you do it, you're going to tell other people to go do it. Stage number four is the Dong Valley portion. So once we finish in the Annapurna Sanctuary and come back out, we'll get a chance to have some hot showers perhaps for the first time. And we're going to immediately either take a bus or a short commuter plane, and we're going to end up in the Dong Valley. It's going to take us about a day to go from Pokhara to Dong. Dong is where I served as a Peace Corps volunteer between 1987 and 1989. And we're going to visit many of my family and friends there, and we're going to be staying with them in their houses. Some of them will put us all up in the second floor. We'll separate out the men from the women, and we'll have you sleeping you separately for cultural reasons there. For literally everybody who's filled out a survey on previous trips, the most impactful section of the trip for every single person has been the visit to the Dong Valley. The Himalaya are awesome, but there's videos that can recreate that. Hanging out with the salt of the earth, walking around with the people whom National Geographic has done multiple stories about, living in mud huts with no running water and limited electricity, and just being loved perhaps like you've never been loved before, typically changes and tickles a person's soul. You're going to get to experience some festivals, because there'll be a lot of singing and dancing associated with the harvest time. And I've timed the trip so that we're going to be there right at the high point of the festival season. So I'll be going through some ceremonies you'll get to watch me participate in because of my status within some of the families over there, which will be interesting for some of you who have never been through that. The last thing we're going to do over there is we're going to visit the schools that we've built. I have been working on and off in Nepal with education specifically for about 30 years. And we're currently finishing our fourth school. It's already in use. They have some side projects we're working on. And I'm going to visit the school board chairman and the management steering committee at each one of these schools and get an update from each one of them about what's going on and what they need. You'll get to go, and for some of you, I'll actually, if your personality seems to be a fit for it, I'll actually ask permission to see if I can have you teach a class, because you'll be the first white person many of these kids have ever seen, and certainly the first native English speaker that most everybody's encountered there, specifically the school-aged kids, and I want them to have as experience with you as best as I can. The last portion of the trip, for sure, is the hardest, and this is universally agreed upon. There's a 0% chance anybody's going to be able to apply empathy to understand what you just went through. Hiking in the Himalaya, people will compare it to the Rockies or the Appalachian Trail or the Sierras and try to come up with something that works for them. It really isn't a fit. It's close, but it's really not a fit. But your time in the Dong Valley is not going to have any connection to anything any of them have experienced, unless they've been a pastor working in the inner city or something like that for a decade or two. You're going to want to reach out and connect with others on the trip when you have these moments when you can't connect with the people who you love or the people in your family because it's challenging and you just kind of have to do high-level conversations with them. That's okay. That's natural. That's normal. Linda and I are going to try to organize a post-event gathering at our house for everybody to get together and just kind of talk through it and share what they've learned. Linda and I both find that to be really meaningful for you. I would encourage you to make sure that if you have no idea about how to train, you get help. I'm a certified coach. I can help you. But there are other people on this, on every single trip, who have a clue about fitness who can help you. And in general, if you walk up to any fitness facility and say, I'm going to go hiking for a week and I need to be able to go 7 miles a day, what should I do? This is not a complicated formula. There's many people who can help you get there from here. So those are the five sections of the trip. Just throw them again real quick. You're going to have a pre-trip stage, which takes the most time. You're going to have a travel segment. You're going to have a hiking segment. You're going to have the in-valley segment. And then you're going to have the return home. So that'll help you kind of quantify everything in your head so you know what you're getting into. So here's some of the questions I've historically gotten and some of the answers I've been given. Normal question is, I feel this is too hard because I've never hiked at that altitude before. Or I've never hiked that many days in a row before. How do I know I can do this? Well, if you live on the East Coast, there are some specific segments on the Appalachian Trail I can send you on that absolutely replicate some of the days we're going to have when we're hiking in the Himalaya. There's one specific segment in the Annapurna Sanctuary where there's this little section on the Tennessee-North Carolina border that very much replicates it. The pitch on the slope, the hiking distance, it's very similar. So for those of you on the East Coast, I can give you that. Another option to stare at, and I'll probably be doing this myself, is it's very cheap and very easy to spend a long weekend in the Tetons. So what I typically will do is get up on the Friday morning before Labor Day, and I'll cash in my frequent flyer miles. And I'll get a flight to Jackson, Wyoming, and spend $10 or $20 and get a shuttle to the start of the Teton Crest Trail. It's a 39-mile trail. And I'll have my food with me. The only thing I'll do is I'll fill up my water bottles. When I get to the tram at the bottom of the valley, I'll just take a ski lift that runs all year round. I'll take it on that Friday before Labor Day to the top of the mountain. And then from there, I'll get on a flight at 6 a.m. in Charlotte. I'll land in Jackson 11 or 12 mountain time. I'll be at the start of the trailhead by 1 p.m. And by 4 p.m. I'll be in the lake region in the Tetons near Death Canyon Shelf. It's very similar elevation to what we're going to be at. The hiking distances per day there very much replicate Annapurna. The temperature, the humidity is all very much a dead match. And that 39-mile hike, that's not that different than what we're going to do Granted, we'll be going a little bit farther, but we're also going to have 2 more days. That whole trip is less than $100, everything all in with 2 taxis and a permit, assuming you can get frequent flyer miles to get you to Jackson. That's a 5-day trip for $100. So for me, that's kind of my test warm-up trip. If any of you are interested in doing that with me, you sure can. It's not challenging, and it is stunning. All right, I cannot afford the trip. That's another question that comes up often and frequently. So maybe half the people who do these trips decide they want to get involved with our nonprofit, the Nepal Project, and help raise money for education and the kids in the valley. Since it's a 501c3 corporation, if you're doing fundraising, you can raise funds to pay for the airplane portion of your flight. That's for normal. You can't use nonprofit money to pay for a vacation hike in the Himalaya. That's not ethical. I won't authorize that. But it's very natural for you to raise money to get the airplane ticket fees needed to go over there and be a part of this. Any missionary who's ever traveled overseas knows that fundraising to cover the cost of the transportation is natural. So you can remove that cost if you want to do some fundraising for the trip. And again, about half the people who do these trips do that very thing. For sure, I'll be doing some fundraising for the trip to do that as well. Health concerns always come up frequently and often. What happens if I get sick? I have health concerns. Do they take U.S. insurance? I have all kinds of questions. This is probably one of the more natural questions that pops up. So to begin with, Nepal's medical world is a stone age or two behind the U.S. world. You can't make the expectation that the emergency medical care in their country will be like ours. That said, for the items that do come up there, specifically acute mountain sickness or altitude sickness, they're probably one of the best equipped countries in the world to handle that because they're so quick to diagnose it and know how to deal with it so much better than people in our country. Like in our country, we're wonderful at handling things like cancer and diabetes because so many people have it. Well, there they're very good at handling acute mountain sickness, which is probably your biggest threat because so many people over there can get it. So just you, the solution to the most likely problem will be in place for you. Nepal does not have prescription laws like our country. So even if you show up and you're out of meds or you're running out of meds, you don't need to call your U.S. doctor to get a prescription refill. You just take your bottle to any of the pharmacies and you hand them the bottle and they'll refill it typically for 1% to 5% on a dollar. I'm going to be buying some meds when I'm there that we're going to be carrying with us on the trail that in our country would be considered prescription meds, but there they're all over the counter. I'm going to have stuff with us in case there's respiratory illness, intestinal issues, aches and pains, all that goes with that. So you'll have a med kit with us. Remember, there's no U.S. prescription laws, so even though I'm not a physician, I can hand you those pills because there's not a liability concern associated with it in that specific country. Now, all that said, if you want to go to your doctor and get refills of everything you might need and then some, power to you. I think that's a great decision. I don't want you to have a fear of COVID for that being a concern for you not going. I know our media and some of our governments have convinced us that that's like the world's ultimate risk. I see too many negative legacies associated with, deciding that we're going to shut down our kids' schooling in the present and dork their education in the future because of our concern of death today. And, in World War II, the British didn't close the schools in London when they were getting bombed every night. So I'm not a fan of, I don't have any space in my heart to accommodate a fear of COVID for not traveling because there's many things you can do to prevent yourself from getting that. And that shouldn't justify tabling your dreams or having an epic vacation. How do I handle the fact that I'm just scared to travel nowadays? I've got that one coming. I've heard that one a few things before. So the more you prepare, the more you plan, the less of a risk you have. So I always travel through the Middle East. I found that the airports, the transportation, the quality of the air carrier going in and out of the Middle East from East Coast of the United States to the Middle East, from the Middle East to Nepal, it's just been always been spectacular, spot clean. Anytime I've needed something, I've been able to get it. I generally don't use a U.S. carrier when I'm flying to the Middle East. Emirates, all those airlines I find to be better than the ones we have in our country. And in general, I feel really safe when I do that. I try to secure an entire row of seats when I possibly can. I'll fly on an off day. so I can sleep. When you take off from the East Coast and go directly to Abu Dhabi, you know, that's something like 18 hours of airtime. And it's great when you have three or four seats you can lay down and have to yourself. And if you just ask, a lot of these flights are not hyper booked. People are generally not flying in and out of the Middle East that time of the year. I've almost always been successful at getting that. It's generally not that challenging. Anything associated with concerns in the international airports, I don't think you should really have those. I think the airports are perhaps some of the safest places in the world right now because of the amount of time and concern associated with keeping things clean. Think if you're a major airport and somebody gets either sick in your airport or gets shot in your airport, how that impacts the entire country in the eyes of the world who are looking for tourist destinations. Now, if you're scared to travel because you're scared when we get inside of the country, I'll address that in a bit. But don't let your fear of what might happen to you when you're going through the Middle East during these uncertain times be something that deter you. Will I be safe? Let's just jump right to that. I would say the world's airports, as I've addressed, are pretty safe. When you're in Nepal, when you land in Nepal, there'll be some moments when you're certainly going to say this is unsafe, specifically when you get on buses and get in some of those taxi rides. It's almost a running joke, a Nepali taxi. What's the difference between a Nepali taxi and riding on a blind horse? Well, the only difference is typically the horse has four hoofs and he's using all of them at any given moment. That's not necessarily true with a taxi. In Nepal, you're going to be with me or a Nepali national whom I know really well, literally almost all the time. Except like when you go to the bathroom in the middle of the night. In Annapurna, we're going to be staying at tea houses the entire time, and those are pretty darn safe places. And everything in Dong, you're going to be safe because you're going to be my guest, and you're going to be being protected by literally everyone I know there. So I would say buses and taxis, no, you're not safe compared to our country. Everywhere else, very much. How do I train for elevation? So there's lots of things you can do to train for elevation. The Annapurna base camp is going to be at something like 4,400 meters up, which in general does not cause that much mountain sickness. It's not like going to some of the higher places in Mustang or higher up on the slopes of Everest where altitude sickness is a bigger issue. I mentioned already that you can do a hike with me in the Tetons. Some people buy hyperbaric chambers, places where you can sleep where it's a reduced atmosphere and precondition your body, and we had a couple that did that. The both of them slept in a hyperbaric chamber in the past, and they said that worked wonders for them. I do not recommend an oxygen-restricted training regimen where you wear a face mask and reduce the amount of oxygen going into your body. That's just not healthy. You'll do that a bit when you're there, but you're only going to do that because you don't have a choice. While you have a choice, go ahead and use all the oxygen available to you. Another question is, I don't know any foreign languages. I'm just a regular American. What do I do? Well, throughout the Middle East where you're going to traverse through, English is common. When you're with me, I'll be handling anything that needs to be done in Nepali. Since I'm fluent in Nepali, I can read it and write it and speak it. And all the porters and people whom I'm going to have you working with, almost all the porters, are going to be bilingual, if not trilingual as well. So we're going to have a support staff with you. But it's a rare day indeed if you can't use English and get around within Nepal. Many of the people who service us and work with us are the younger generation, and most of them were immersed in English in school starting in a very early grade. Wildlife threats. Are there any wildlife threats? The abominable snowman, the proverbial yak attack, things like that. I have never seen an abominable snowman while I've been over there, the proverbial yeti. And I have certainly seen yaks too many times to count, but they've never been a threat. They don't have any poisonous snakes in Nepal. There are king cobras in India, but in the portions of Nepal we're going to be in, those are generally not threats. And I'm hoping that all the threat associated with our U.S. elections will have long since passed by then as well. Ha ha. All right, sleeping at night. People say, well, where am I sleeping? I don't have awareness when I'm unconsciously out. Give me as much guidance on that as you can. So when you're in transit traveling across the world, that's on you. Where you want to sleep in transit, that's not included in the cost of the trip. But you're with me, what I've included is we have traditional hotels of the sort you would find anywhere, as I'd say, in the world. When you're with me in Kathmandu on the first day and the last day, When we're on the trail, we're going to be staying in tea houses, is what they're called. And when we're in Dong, we're going to be staying in mud huts. So let me do a little momentary thing with a tea house. A tea house is basically an unheated, uncooled concrete structure nowadays. It used to be just tea, mud and sticks, with the equivalent of hotel rooms in it. And these are going to be beds made out of wood that'll have a thin mattress, a pillow, and a couple of really thick quilts slash comforters. You'll have a window. You may or may not have electricity. You most certainly will not have running water in your room. There'll probably be a group bathroom in the hall. The bathroom will just have it'll be a hole in the floor with a bucket of water nearby. So you do your business, stand up, and then take the bucket and pour water down until your business is no longer visible. That's what a typical tea house is. So you don't need, I mean, you can carry a sleeping bag. I carry a sleeping bag as a safety measure in case there's an issue. But there's thick comforters as well as pillows in every place we're going to stay. In Dong, we're going to be in some of my friends' houses. You'll be sleeping on bamboo mats, typically on the floor. Some of us will be able to sleep in beds. There may be some padded mattresses, or there may not be. So in those moments, I would slide inside of a sleeping bag or on top of a sleeping pad. And I'm sure we can rustle up enough pillows so that you won't have a need for pillows, or you can ball yourself up and make a ball out of your clothing to use as a pillow. So 2 nights in hotels, 7 or 8 nights in tea houses, probably 7 nights in tea houses, and then three nights in mud huts. Is it safe to drink the water? No. You need to either purify your water or buy bottled water when you're there. And it's kind of a split as to what you want to do. I'm going to be bringing a gravity-fed water purifier with me. So I'm going to fill this bag up with water and hang it basically at my head height or above. And it's got a tube. Gravity pulls the water out of the bag and it filters it. It makes about a quart a minute or so, so it doesn't make water very quickly. Anybody who wants to can use that to make water. Or you can buy bottled water. Bottled water is available there all over the place. It's safe. It's relatively inexpensive. You can recycle the bottle if you want to. You don't need to concern yourself with whether or not water is clean or not if it's first since been boiled. Like every time we stop and get a cup of tea, or for those of you who bring things to make coffee with and you get some boiling water from the person who owns the tea house, that water probably need not be filtered and purified. Other than that, though, you'll need to concern yourself with that. And that does include brushing your teeth. A common way people get stomach bugs there is they brush their teeth just using a drop or two of water from the tap, and well, that's all it takes. Do you need any vaccines before you go? In general, U.S. childhood vaccines are good enough. There's no additional vaccines on any of the lists I've ever seen specific to traveling to the Himalayan region. So that ties it all up. I hope that helped. If you have more questions, you can ask me. Just email me, jeff@thresholdacademy, or you can just reply to this video. Thanks for listening to this chapter of Threshold Stories, Crossing Thresholds, One Story at a Time. Get ready to cross more thresholds with me in 2 weeks. If you have any questions, feel free to reach out to me directly. You can find me on LinkedIn or on my Facebook page at Jeff Gora Team USA.